So internet voting is a subject that is guaranteed to stir up controversy and debates. I have been asked by the panelists to request that no objects be thrown until after at least the introductions have been completed. Beyond that, we have to give people a fair chance. But especially after this past weekend's FVAP UOKAVA working session, I think there was a lot of interesting discussion there. And this is a subject that has come up many times in many places. And we are moving forward in some ways. I'm delighted to have a great panel. Christian Bull, Craig Burton, Barbara Simons, and Benedita are here. I'll introduce each of them in a little bit more detail as they speak. We'll have each of them speak for a few minutes and then try to save half the time for questions. So first, let me pull up the information I have and go from there. Okay. So Christian Bull's going to start things off. He describes himself as a computer nerd. He worked on internet voting pilots in the UK as an intern for election.com, as chief security officer of National Insurance, and is now responsible for security and technology in the Norwegian eVote 2011 project, which goes live tomorrow. Indeed. So, Christian, please take it away. Let me bring up your deck. And there we go.
Right. California time, it's actually midnight tonight. It's crazy that I am here, but here I am. And yes, I do have tickets to a non-extradition country. I really like this poster, which asks the question in German, are you sure that your vote will be counted correctly? It's from a 2009 pilot performed in Austria. Now, I've basically just made a bunch of slides. I have 7 minutes. I have a lot to say. I'll try to get through as much as possible. First, a bit of Norway background. It's a tiny, tiny country. People actually have to look up in the Wikipedia because they don't trust me when I say we have 3.3 million voters in total in the country. It's a very rich country, and it's a very big country, about the length of the United States from Southern California to the Canadian border. We have a fairly considerable, in terms of the small electorate, expats population, because we have an unpleasant climate, so people tend to go south whenever they can. Biannual elections, parliamentary elections every 4 years and local elections every 4 years. So they're offset by 2 years. What we're going into now is local elections. So it's municipal and county elections that we are piloting this is. We also have very infrequent non-binding referenda. One of the big challenges in our system is that voters get to make changes to the ballot. We don't have a huge number of contests like I see you have here in the US with 30 pages of contests. We only have two contests, municipal and county. However, as you'll see later, the voter gets to make a lot of changes in those contests. The pilot we're doing now, 167,000 voters eligible in 10 municipalities. Those 10 municipalities are in 9 different counties. So those counties also do e-voting. Now, it's end-to-end verifiable, but there might be some controversy in my use of that term, actually. Voters get a proof that the ballot is stored as cast. Now, we can't do universal verifiability. That's because of the way the ballot is made. I'll talk a bit more about that later. So I refer to it as verification by proxy. You have to have an expert in to do the verification. Detailed design documentation and source code available on this URL. I've just put it in here because I'm sure you'll get the slides later. So you can have a look at just how it works. I certainly invite you to do that. Now, we think that a basic premise for e-voting is that the population trusts the government not to be one massive monolithic conspiracy against the population. That doesn't mean that the system shouldn't be robust against minor conspiracies within the government. Now, I invite you to have a look at that. One of the important premises is we have what's called an untrusted client domain, meaning we do not trust what goes on the client. When I came into the project, when I was sitting in my other comfortable job, and I saw the ad for this job, which I have now, I thought, wow, they're nuts. What are they doing? And then I was invited to apply for the job, and I did, and here I am. Because I just couldn't see how you could do internet voting securely, considering what we know about the untrusted client. There will be some trust in government, but that trust isn't supposed to be blind. Now, obviously, I can't go into the finer details here. I just have to rush through this. This is the standard internet voting, right? You do the encryption of the ballot, and you do the digital signature on the client side, right? Problem appears just about in the red circle there, where on the client side, the clear text ballot before encryption is manipulated by some attacker. Now, how on earth were we going to fix that? That was the big question going in. Now, what we did, I like to run around and point and stuff, but I can't do that now. The voter logs on, submits his vote in clear text. The e-voting system does some processing server side and returns a proof of recorded as cast to the voter via a second channel, an SMS message to the cell phone. Okay? The voter has a poll card. This is actually a third channel, a mail channel, a postal regular snail mail channel, where the voter can compare this return code, which is just a number, it doesn't mean anything to me, and check that, oh, my vote was indeed recorded as cast. This is basically how the system looks from a conceptual. It has a vote collection server, which is the server which actually accepts the votes. This has one secret. It performs an operation on the recorded ballot, sends it off to the return code generator, which has a different secret. This is not a deep, dark secret, but if these two secrets of the vote collection server and the return code generator, they are, in fact, enough information to construct the private key. That's kind of scary. And that's why they are separated not only in function, but also geographically. They are, in fact, in two data centers 700 kilometers apart, so that they are operated by people who don't really know each other. This is basically trying to keep the conspiracy as large as possible. Some people might not be happy with that. I'm perfectly happy to discuss that choice. It's basically because the problem, the big problem, we think, is on the client side. The insider threats are more manageable. Now, this is where I'm sure there will be some controversy. Right, so this is how the client looks to the voter. I think it's important that you see this. Basically, this is the front page. It's in Norwegian, so you'll have to bear with me. Pressing gå videre, which is to move on, you authenticate using an authentication system. Now, every citizen in Norway has access to this authentication system. Basically add your national ID number and a password, and then there's a challenge for a dynamic password, and you're in. And here you can choose between the two races that are on the ballot at this point, which is the county on top and municipal downstairs. We press municipal, which is the most interesting and where the voter can make the most changes. Here's the list of parties running for this race. It is randomized. Every time you log on, you get in a different order. The top here is the Socialist Left Party. They left behind revolutionary Marxism about 20 years ago. But that's so we're going to choose that one because it came out on top this time around. So what you see now is the gray button down in the corner changes to orange. Show ballot. Okay, because in Norway you have individual ballot papers per party. So now I've selected one ballot paper, and I am presented now with a fairly long list of candidates on that ballot. Now, every one of these candidates will get my vote, along with the party. However, the ones in bold, they get a quarter extra vote, and that's been decided by the party, because they like these candidates a little bit more than the other candidates. Okay? That's a long list, 29 candidates for this party. They can be different lengths according to parties. Now, two orange buttons, make changes to ballot, or go on without making changes to ballot. Now, obviously, I'm going to make changes to the ballot. So now I get checkboxes next to the names. Okay? Okay, so I check a few candidates. When I check them, they each get an extra personal vote. A full extra vote. Not just a quarter, but a full extra vote. Okay? Now, down here, that's sort of a write-in thing. Because, okay, I like the socialist left. But from the Labour Party, I like Morten Sandbakken. So I want to add him to my add him. What that does, in fact, is it takes away 1/29th of my party votes. Okay? It takes away 1/29th of my party vote, and it gives it to the Labour Party for that specific candidate. Does anybody want to try hand counting this? So I press gå videre med endring på stemmeseddel, which is go on with the changes. Okay, I'm now presented with my final ballot, which is a party vote to the socialist left with special candidate votes to these six candidates, and I include a candidate from the Labour Party. Now, as you can understand, this is not easy to count manually. It's an absolute nightmare. In fact, very few Norwegian municipalities have done manual counts for 30 years. We've been using optical scan of paper ballots. Voters take paper ballots, they fill them out, make all their little changes, and they put them in the ballot box, and they are scanned. Obviously, we've been using private vendors, we have no ID, there's no certification, nothing. Everybody just trusts this and assumes it'll go well. We have some interesting examples of it not going well, which is part of why this project also involves a government-owned system for this. Anyway, now I've pressed submit, my vote is encrypted. This actually takes time because the complexity of the ballot and the number of zero knowledge proofs and blah, blah, blah. So it takes 30, 40 seconds if you're very quick. It does lots of pre-computation in the background, so usually it counts up to 100 fairly quickly. Now, after about 15, 30 seconds of wait time on the server side in generating the return code, which also does a lot of zero knowledge proof checking, blah, 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 I'm presented with this. Thank you for voting. Your vote has been registered, blah, blah, blah. You will soon receive an SMS text message with a return code on your phone. Please check it against your polling card, and if it's not incorrect, call this number right away, because we want to know. And then we're back here, and I can select the next contest. Now, this is the SMS. It says, hello, Ida Stenerud, who is my assistant. Your vote for the municipal election was received at timestamp. You voted for party with code 6607. And this is the big crucial point. This number means nothing to me as an electoral management body. I don't know what it means. Because we have printed the poll cards in such a way that that knowledge no longer exists. So the vote is still anonymous, even though I am able to tell you what it is. And then it specified you gave six personal votes and you added a write-in from a different party. We could actually have included votes return codes to specify exactly which candidate you made changes for. However, I am now out of time. So I'm not going to go into why, but it's a usability thing. It becomes very long and very complex for the voter. Okay, I'm just going to leave that up there. Okay.
Thank you, Christian. That's a clever way to get a little extra time while I introduce the next speaker. But unfortunately for you, I have to pull up next slides also. So next speaker is Craig Burton. He was the founder of Everyone Counts. He left there in 2008, if I have it correctly, became a consultant in e-voting, and is now the e-voting manager at the Victorian Electoral Commission in Australia. He was part of a large internet voting project in New South Wales, a separate large rollout of network voting kiosks in Victoria, and several similar government voting projects. So with that, let me pull up Craig's slides, and there you go.
All right. Thank you for that, Josh. I'll try and keep it fairly short. And as introduced, I've had a fairly long history in this, and my role has changed very dramatically. So I was the founder of Everyone Counts, and I wrote its system, but now I work for the government really completely on the other side of the moat, as it were. I'm going to give a quick summary of some of the things that I tried in my time, concluding in the largest and most elaborate government election. I was part of a bit of a project to use Open Social, Google's Open Social, to use reputation systems to help identify voters who are overseas. So we made a certain amount of progress on that, and that was while I was still within the company. Another one was we hacked the Freenet client and set up our own Freenet on the Planet Lab. The Planet Lab is a huge research cloud computing system. And our idea was to use effectively illegal file sharing network to traffic encrypted votes, which could then be harvested off the network by one or more electoral authorities. So this was another experiment. And it's anticipating military voting. We made a machine that lets profoundly disabled people vote through the phone with a sip and puff device. That includes write-ins. So can you imagine writing Mickey Mouse by sipping and puffing on the phone? Right. And finally, one of the biggest projects was in 2007, where we provided a web-based solution over a private military network to Australian servicemen and women in four active war zones. And we had about three times as many people vote. It's hard to compare between elections, but certainly a larger turnout on the system. And that was really the sort of the top end of my time with them. I now work at the Victorian Electoral Commission. It runs the elections for the state, and in fact it's the law that the Commission runs a whole range of elections. It's the only body that can run a whole class of union elections, for example. In Australia we have the single transferable vote. It's a more complex system, more elaborate. If you don't vote in the state election or in the district elections, you get fined $150. Sometimes we issue so many fines it pays for the district election. The VEC runs elections all the time. It's all it does all the time. It just runs elections, and there's always something running, a by-election or whatever. Unlike here, the model at the VEC is that it's highly trusted. And in that regard, we have an exemption from the Equal Employment Opportunity Act, which lets us discriminate the people we hire on the basis of their political affiliations. So if you are or have been a political party member, you can't work for us. And in fact, they changed this law fairly recently, and we had this Stalinist purge of all our staff. And several people were retired from the staff because they had political affiliations. Interestingly, the VEC doesn't run the federal arm of the national election. So when we run a national election, a state body comes down from the Fed and runs it. We don't touch it. We just sit and watch. We're also a very heavy user of IT. There's continuous software development going on all the time at the VEC, and it's a highly automated place. The big project I was involved in since I started there was the rolling out of a large network of 400 devices. 300 of them were SIP phones. So a SIP phone is like a digital phone running on a private network. It's just another internet device. And kiosks, which were common PCs inside a hardened case. And it was specifically for the blind, vision impaired, the culturally and linguistically diverse, which is how we say can't speak English, and the motor disabled. We asked Parliament if they would let us serve people who simply couldn't vote on their own, that's the language we wanted, but instead they wanted these categories, and But close, almost most people who can't vote alone. It's all supervised. So the voting on these phones or the voting on these kiosks all took place in polling stations, and the polling stations were all networked with this enormous private network. And I've got my infrastructure head with me, Shripad Joshi, who was set that up, a huge job. We ran a very highly customized version of Seitel's commercial product. So it was customized for the Australian election system, and it answered the phones, and it ran in the kiosks, and it ran on the servers centrally. It had lots and lots and lots of security, kind of like Arnold Schwarzenegger on steroids. And I chose that bad metaphor on purpose because there can't really be enough security, and it's sort of the end game for tamper resistance. I've now learnt that tamper evidence is really the game. Did it? God, I hope not. And ultimately, unfortunately, after all our assessments, although it was successful and a whole lot of people got to vote on their own for the first time in their lives, some of the data really suggested it was very complex and hard to operate at the polling station and hard for us to operate because of the amount of security and all the cards, the checks, the certificates, the passwords, and so on. At one point, the provider wanted it so that to set up a phone vote, you had to enter a 32-digit code. Okay, we got that down to a few fewer digits than that. The VEC is very interested in transparency, and it has very transparent elections, and it has a mature system for scrutineers who represent parties and candidates, but only to a point. So there reaches a point where we start to count our votes electronically, and they're keyed in, and it's not transparent from there on. But thank you to Dr. Vanessa Teague, who I met here in San Jose, even though she lives a mile from my house. She's an active writer to Parliament and arguer for transparency, and so I was able to convince the Commission to create a new role under the Electoral Act such that Vanessa could come and be a non-aligned, not party-aligned, technical observer. And then the provider of the technical system was obliged to write a big document in technical parlance describing the crypto design. I had the system white hat hacked. Vanessa told them things to look for. Vanessa told the auditor, who was looking at the source code, for things to poke at. Ooh, what's this?
Something to ignore, I'm sure. There.
And the outcome was a much better system, I think, ultimately. I think that the provider worked a lot harder, and I think it was a better system. And, man, I hope some of the other commissions can be convinced to do it, because what's coming next is a very strong push for me to provide internet voting. When I say soon, it could be 1 to 5 years. Internet voting for the blind, vision impaired from home, from the VEC. I happen to know there's a system for internet voting being built completely from scratch in Western Australia, targeting an election next year. I know that internet voting has been considered and proposed for a pile of council elections in New South Wales in November next year. And the VEC wants to do a whole lot more commercial voting. So what I wanted to say to this audience here is what is it that the VEC can do to help with the progress of safe, transparent voting protocols, be they for remote voting or precinct voting? What is it that we can do to help a candidate system be proposed or to help researchers? Because we certainly have the means to help, and we can only gain from helping. Thank you.
Okay, let's try to do it in this order this time. I'm happy to welcome Barbara Simons. She's been a researcher at IBM and president of the Association for Computing Machinery. She was a member of the workshop that was convened at the request of President Clinton that produced a report on internet voting in 2001. And she co-authored the report that led to the cancellation of the Department of Defense's internet voting project known as CERV. She now serves on the board of advisors of the U.S. Election Assistance Commission and has co-authored, together with Doug Jones, a book on voting technology that's tentatively titled Broken Ballots, Will Your Vote Count? That will be published early next year. So, Barbara, thank you.
So first, I just want to talk very briefly about something which was mentioned last night at the Rump session. So many of you may have already heard about this. Joel talked about the FVAP's proposal for how to proceed with the Internet Voting Project, which they feel they are required to do by Congress. And what came up in the meeting that was just before this one was that they would follow the model that was used for AES crypto, for developing the AES crypto system, and open this all up to challenge at every level and interaction at every level. So there would again be three steps, with step zero, of course, being the constraints, and because we couldn't even figure out what it is exactly that they should be doing. So we decided, that obviously should be a step. So conditions and requirements that a system should meet. And this would be public submissions, just as was done with the AES system. And people could critique each other's submissions, and there could be iterations until there was a more or less agreed upon set of constraints. The second step would be the system descriptions that would be written designs that would be submitted, again, public, again, open to critique, and again, with multiple iterations if necessary. And then the third step would be the actual coded systems, again, public. So the idea is that each step could involve more than one iteration. Vendors could have patents and trademark and copyright on their submissions, but not trade secrets, obviously, because this would all be public. So this is taking a very different perspective from what we've observed in the past, when we've had these meetings and people have been pretty much at each other's throats. And the hope is that this is a way in which we can proceed forward and either come up with a system which we all feel very comfortable with, or if necessary, say we just can't do it. So from that, I want to move on to Estonia. And I want to talk about Estonia because, well, for two reasons. First of all, I was just there. And you think that Norway is small. Everybody I met in Estonia kept on telling me how very, very small it is. 1.34 million people. The weather, I have to say, was lovely. And they said that, yes, those were the few days that weren't good for skiing. Of course, because it's lovely, a lot of people are away on vacation now, so not much is going to happen between now and the end of August, as you'll see when I talk about how things are happening here. Anyway, I had a lovely time. People were very, very nice. And I got to learn more about what's happening there with the Internet voting. Now, from my perspective, having met some people there, I really care that they should have good, secure elections. But even if I hadn't met anybody, I would care, because one of the issues is that even though most of the focus at this meeting has been on technical issues, we are working in a political environment as well. And Estonia is frequently held up as an existence proof of how internet voting can be done and done successfully. And what I want to argue is, yes, it's being done, but it's not secure. And in fact, I've been amazed at how many people I've mentioned this to who completely agree with me on this. So they had an election this March. The internet portion lasted from February 23rd to March 2nd. And some of this stuff I've just learned recently from iterating with some of the people, from communicating with some of the people there. The counting actually started on March 3rd for the internet portion, even though the polling place voting didn't start till March 6th. Because the internet portion ended March 2nd, any complaints had to be filed within 72 hours. Apparently, this is law in Estonia. So any complaint about the internet portion of the election had to be filed by March 5th, even before the polling place election had begun. Now, another thing that happened was there was a team of observers from the OSCEODIHR, which stands for Organization for Security and Cooperation in Europe, / Office for Democratic Institutions and Human Rights. There were no computer security experts on this panel of observers. They were mainly policy people. So what happened in the election? What? I'm sorry, am I wrong about that? Oh, okay. This is what I'd been told. I beg your pardon. So you can correct me if I have anything wrong about what was said. So what happened was, in this election, the Center Party came in second. They did well in the paper voting, not so well in internet voting. There's a plausible explanation for why they didn't do so well in internet voting, which was that the election was held in, that portion was held in Estonian, the Estonian language, and a significant percentage of the members of the Center Party are Russian speakers. So that is, an explanation for why they may not have done so well. Nonetheless, members of this party are questioning the correctness of the internet tally. And of course, as we know, this is the sort of thing where we can neither prove that it was correct nor prove that it was wrong, because there is no way to audit it. So the OSCE report observed that the National Election Commission, or NEC, had no IT experts on it. One programmer verified the code, but the results were secret. I mean, this was a known thing that one programmer verified the code. The project manager could update the software without any formal procedure. All ballots were destroyed on April 11th. Again, this is Estonian law that says the ballots have to be destroyed within a certain period of the completion of the election, which I found quite curious coming from the U.S., where by law ballots have to be retained for at least 22 months. And the NEC can invalidate the internet election results, but as the report observed, the law does not specify how to inform voters, or I think even on how they would decide to invalidate the law. So there are questions about this, and the report had a number of recommendations for ways of dealing with some of these issues. Now, I mentioned Paavo, does anyone know how to pronounce his last name? Paavo, I shall call him, who was a graduate student at Estonia. Some of you may have heard about him because there was some news after the election that he was challenging the result, and we discovered that he was a graduate student in history, which everybody, at least I thought, was rather curious. Turns out he's a bit geeky, I should say. He's very much into aviation simulation electronics, and so he actually likes to play with computers, which is why he was able to do some of these things. So on March 5th, which was within the 72-hour time limit, he petitioned the NEC to cancel the election. And his claim was that there's a risk of election rigging malware on voters' computers. Now, I have to say that everyone I've talked to about this has acknowledged that this is a risk. And, The NEC dismissed the complaints, and they stated that they had all the necessary provisions to detect the problems, but they did not specify what those provisions were. Excuse me. The project manager said the threat was theoretically possible, but nearly impossible to implement. And the Supreme Court dismissed his appeal because his rights had not been breached, and he was not allowed to file a general complaint. That the risks of others had been breached and there were no minimum standards. Now, one of the issues I feel with this whole system is the lack of transparency and openness. Again, the reports say that the reported tests were often informal or kept secret. And Paavo has requested all the reports, and we've since learned, and I don't think the committee knew this at the time, that the code audit was done by Martin Piljak, who became ill during the process, so there was no written report, although he may have been given some initial feedback. And basically, Paavo communicated with him, and he said the auditing of the source code was not carried out because of his illness. So the report that was known about, there is no written report. Another issue is the separation of the votes from the voters, and basically, I won't read this. This is a quote from another paper. But you've got this problem where you have the voters and the votes connected, and you've got to separate them in such a way that you don't reveal how a voter had voted. Excuse me. And there are issues there. So here are some of the risks of anonymizing the process. And here you basically have a privacy concern, but as was stated before, you also have to worry about ballot box stuffing or having ballots discarded. And finally, and this is, I think, one of the most important points, anyone who wants to look at the software or test it has to sign an NDA. Now, one of the things I suggested when I was there was that it would make sense to bring in an outside a committee of outside experts, prominent international experts who are independent, who could look at the software and test it, much as was done in Washington. And there are a number of people, some of whom are in the room right now, who are interested in doing that, but they don't want to do it if they have to sign an NDA. So at this point, the issue in Estonia is this NDA, and hopefully efforts there, which will be going on there, I guess, when everyone comes back from vacation to try to get rid of the NDA, will be successful, and there will be some real tests. Thank you.
So much for no slides.
So much for no slides.
Okay. So you put up slides, and I can introduce you while...
Sounds good. While I wrangle the video monster.
So while Ben is getting... I will get that right side up and say that Ben earned his PhD from MIT, where his dissertation focused on secure voting. He led the development of and continues to maintain Helios, one of the first and most widely used web-based open audit software voting systems. He is currently tech lead on identity and user data at Mozilla. So, Ben, take it away.
Thanks, Josh. All right, I'm going to try to keep this very short so we have a little time for questions. I want to tell you very briefly about Helios because a bunch of you already know about it. It's a web-based, and I want to tell you about Helios and tell you the important property of it, it's and what it can and what it cannot do, and then hopefully tell you one point that might stir up a little controversy because I think that's the goal. Helios is a web-based, open-source, end-to-end verifiable voting system. You can go download it now. Not last year's version, not last week's version, today's version. The code is that's on the server is always, the source code is always up to date with what's on the server. I think that's a baseline. We shouldn't be discussing voting systems that don't have disclosed source code. If you want to keep IP rights, that's fine. But they should be all disclosed source so we can all observe them at least at that level. And the end-to-end verifiable aspect of it is really important. And at a high level, this is what it means. Your voice, your choice, is encrypted via some randomized encryption system. The only thing that means is that two yeses don't encrypt to the same thing. Otherwise, it would be obvious that, you know, who voted yes and who voted no. That part, the encryption, is done in private. In Helios, it's done inside your web browser. Not with the web browser talking to the server. It's actually done in your web browser. You can take your web browser offline when you do the actual encryption. And then the plain texts are removed, and only then does it send the ciphertext to the server. Then the encrypted votes are aggregated using homomorphic tallying, which is basically like counting under the covers of encryption. It's pretty magical if you haven't seen it. You get to add numbers without decrypting them, and you only decrypt the tally, which is pretty cool. And then at the outcome, you get the tally, and you get some proof of the decryption. The end-to-end verifiability means that you don't need any kind of special privilege to be able to verify from start to finish that things happened as they should have. You don't need to play golf with an election official so you can be the right person. You know, like that happens, but you know what I mean. You don't have to be in a privileged position to watch the election. You can just look at the data and run code that you write or run code that somebody writes to audit it. And if there's a last-minute change, Barbara is very right to be concerned about last-minute changes to source code on voting systems that are not end-to-end verifiable. But if there's a last-minute change in a voting system that is end-to-end verifiable, it doesn't matter as long as the specifications for the proofs are followed. As long as you can still verify them, it's okay if you have to tweak a line of code, because if that line of code messes up the proof, we're going to find out, and we'll be able to detect that and do something about it. So Helios looks like this. It's web-based. You get to select your choice. You get to encrypt it in your browser. You get a receipt that is pretty long right now. That's the hash of your vote. You can go try it out at heliosvoting.org. And the most interesting thing about end-to-end verifiable voting system is this graphic, which if you've seen me talk, you've probably seen it three times, and I'm sorry, but I think it's the most awesome thing about these systems. This is a participation graphic of the Princeton winter 2009 runoff election, where something went wrong because it looked like the sophomore who was running had a whole bunch of friends who never got the email to tell them to vote, to remind them to vote. And he said, there's a problem, help me, I said, I don't know how I can help you, but I can look at all of the data we have on the server because the votes themselves are encrypted. So it's perfectly safe for me to go in and look at all the metadata. And that's what I did. And if you look at the participation rates by year, you'll see that when the reminder was sent out, which is that second smaller spike over there, the yellow line, which is the sophomores, they just don't spike nearly as much as everybody else. And based on this graphic, which was sent to the administration at Princeton, to say, oh, you know what, it looks like there is a problem. I don't see a spike there like I see in other years. It doesn't make any sense. And they looked at their database, their email alias, and they discovered, because they investigated because of this graphic, they discovered that the email alias for the sophomores had become corrupted the night before, and only 10% of the sophomores had received the email. When you have a system where you can look at exactly what's happening, you can find these problems, because these problems will always happen. And so the question is whether you can detect them and whether you can address them. This has been deployed in a bunch of places, but the one problem I cannot solve with Helios is client-side security. The one problem I don't know how to address is the fact that we now have documented evidence, so I can address the server side. I can address the fact that we have verifiability from every input to every output on the server side. It requires a significant deployment to do it right, but it can be done, I think. The client side I don't know how to do yet, because we have documented evidence that viruses like Stuxnet that corrupt nuclear power plants by spreading from one Windows machine to the other have been built. We know this has happened. And so if we run a very large-scale election for a president of a you know, G8 country, why wouldn't we see a similar scenario? Certainly it's worth just as much money. It's worth just as much strategically. And I don't know how we address that. I don't know how we address that point, because all the verifiability doesn't change the fact that a client-side corruption in my browser can flip my vote even before it's encrypted. And if we want every voter to, if we must have a lot of voters verify their process, I think we're going to lose, because most voters don't quite do that yet. There are theoretical constructs to address this. In practice, I think we're not quite there yet. Okay, so now that I've said what I don't think we can do, here's what I think is going to happen. I think internet voting is terrifying, but I think it might be inevitable. And so I say this not as someone who's pushing it. I say this as someone looking at it and saying, I hear all of us telling you all these scary anecdotes about all these failure modes and all these things that can go wrong, and I don't think it matters anymore. Because I think that, because from what I hear, in about a year, France is going to do online voting for president for its citizens that live outside the country, because it's just too complicated logistically to have them vote in person. That's 1.5 million people for a margin of victory that's approximately a million. So this is happening, and I think it's going to start happening here via the military first. I think it's going to expand beyond that. And so I think we need to ask ourselves the question, as experts in this field, at which point do we have to say, you know what? There are some serious problems here that we do not know how to solve, but it's going to happen. And so maybe we need to find a way to make it as safe as possible. And I fully realize that what that means is that if we do it too early, we might be enabling the transition to internet voting. But if we do it too late, we might be stuck with a very, very bad system. So there we go.
Thank you, Ben. I've got a bunch of questions that I would love to ask. People can line up, and if nobody lines up too quickly, I'll start asking my questions, and we'll see how far that gets. But why don't we start with the audience, and we'll probably never get to any of my questions then. So, Neil, please go ahead.
Hi, Neil McBurnett, OASIS CML committee. So Barbara brought up the FFAP contest idea, and one thing that you mentioned, actually to my surprise, and that I've heard kind of going back and forth as different people describe it, is the notion of allowing patents. I know that disclosed source versus open source, I actually wrote a paper for NIST or a white paper in 2003 saying disclosed source is good and sufficient. It's okay to retain that kind of rights to an implementation. But I think patents is a wholly different thing. First of all, in the AES and the SHA-3 competitions that are kind of the model for this. Patents are allowed in the sense that you can submit something that's patented, but if it is chosen as the standard, then you actually have to relinquish any rights to that to enforce the patent, or something close to that. Maybe somebody will correct me on the details. But the notion of having an effort like this that could end up with proprietary control over really anything. I mean, a patent would allow you to prevent people from testing the system. It would allow you to prevent all kinds of things and put a whole lot of effort behind a particular implementation and monopoly power for 20 years is a really bad idea. So
I hope we don't do that.
Is
this on?
Yes.
Oh, okay. I share a lot of your concerns. And I think what we have to think about is the politics here again. We don't want the vendors to pull out completely, because if they pull out, then I think this won't go forward. So we want something which will get the vendors involved, but which will also not, I mean, people should be able to test it. So I don't know quite what the right approach is, and this might be something that could be discussed at the zero phase, just what kinds of rights should be permitted and not permitted. Maybe limits on patents that, I mean, I know that, for example, people with crypto, there, you know, you have to be able to make this stuff available at reasonable prices, stuff like that. I don't know what the right point is for this, because I share your concern. We want to be able to test. We want anyone to be able to build a system. On the other hand, we don't want to scare away the vendors and have them lobbying against this. So, you know, it's. I don't know what the right thing is. I see enough of a
carrot in terms of being the one that was actually proven to work well that would scare up. I mean, so much of the profit in this business is actual end user support and so on. There's plenty of ways for someone who actually ends up demonstrating a system, if they can do that, that solves the problem. So I think it would be enough incentive. Anyway,
you may be right. I'm not going to argue with you because I have your concerns. I share your concerns.
Hi, I'm David Bismarck from the University of Surrey in the UK. I was one of two new voting technologies analysts to the parliamentary election in Estonia in February and March. And I just wanted to add some things to what Barbara was saying. So my background is technical, so I probably count as a security, IT security expert.
They didn't tell me that. All right. Sorry.
And if you're part of one of these, so it's an election analysis mission, and it's a huge international organization, so I can't say much. We wrote an internal memo, which was 70 pages long, and this was cut down to some 6 pages. But that's the way it goes. But I do think that the OSCE ODIHR took the observation of the Estonian internet election quite seriously, because we were two people there for 4.5 weeks. And it can be argued that you can't really observe an internet voting system, but we observed everything. We looked at everything. The one thing that we had that international researchers don't have is we hired translators, because they purposefully only publish the documentation of the system in Estonian, and this is for security purposes, because they don't want the Russian hackers to get hold of this and then find, you know, this is, it's security by obscurity. So we started translating all these documents and we looked at them. But one of our recommendations was actually to at least publish documentation in English, so that, because I'm an international researcher, I would love to delve into this, and now I had a chance, but others would like to as well. But when I say our report was cut down to 6 pages, that was 6 pages of a, I don't know, 18-page report, and all the other analysis got significantly less than the new voting technologies section did. So with regard to that report, we actually asked about the source code review, and we were told repeatedly that they had hired this programmer, but for security reasons, they kept his name secret, and his report was also secret. But now it transpires that he never did an analysis, and we actually...
A written report.
A written report, yeah. But we were told that the report was existed and was filed. So we made a formal request for this documentation, and we were told we couldn't have it. So we actually did ask for these things, and I think we did a pretty thorough job. And I think the main thrust was to give Estonia a set of recommendations on what they can do better. And then, I mean, we can look at it from the outside and say it might still not be good enough. But I think OSCE is still taking it seriously because there are now 3 experts in Norway. Well, they make 5 trips or something. I can't remember. And the last thing is that this hacker fellow, he wasn't a student of history. He was a student of contemporary history.
Right.
I interviewed him, and he's very friendly.
By the way, the way he found out, I got that information from Paavo, the student, and the way he found out that there was no report was that he filed the Estonian equivalent of a FOIA, a Freedom of Information Act. And then it turns out there was no written report. And somebody else got the name of the programmer, and so he wrote to the programmer directly. So that's a source of the information.
I think the best way to keep a report secret is simply not to write.
So I'm John Sebas of Open Source Digital Voting Foundation, and I wanted to provide a particular thanks for the report on the Norway, because it confirmed 3 reasons why the situation there is very, very different than the United States in terms of trusting the government, submitting to a national ID system, having a federal elections authority that conducts elections, and I could even add to that having the Federal Elections Authority having sufficient budget and expertise to actually run a credible IT shop, none of which apply in the nation of the U.S. nor in the county election offices of the U.S. So I can't resist pointing that out. But I did want to make a connection between the report from Estonia, the information that you provided us about the technical operations in Norway, and some of Ben's remarks. So I really respect the work that the OCSE team did, and I kind of got an impression from the report that got published what the tip of the iceberg was and where the rest of the iceberg might have been. But Barbara, I wonder if you would share my assessment that just the stuff that was in the report, all by itself, okay, and just the stuff in the report that talked about the data center and the people and the IT operations. I mean, forget about, you know, the possible viruses on your browser and all that. Just that part really makes it very clear in very nice diplomatic language that IT operation had really no effective personnel security, procedural control, software integrity, and no ability to determine which software did the election, no ability to determine whether the people with privileged access to the systems manipulated the data. None of that actually obtained. And it was said very nicely in this report, but that's a strong statement. Any contradictions for that strong statement?
Well, I mean, the fact that that somebody could get in and make last-minute changes to the software with no oversight was kind of disturbing.
Okay. Okay, great. So so the connection to Norway is I hope that there is a similar analysis and maybe even a self-analysis of your IT operations that could show how that operation has a superior degree of operational integrity. And if you want some help specifying what that assessment would be, I'd be happy to help, because I already have a nice long wish list that derives from experience in doing security assessments of data center operations in for-profit companies in North America, which is, you know, a pretty good metric, okay? And then lastly, I want to stop and let Ben talk for a minute, which is I tend to discount the client malware problem for 2 reasons. One is the technology exists to really mitigate that. There's a real adoption and enforcement issue. There's an interesting report from AFRL that came out recently. We can talk about that later for the techie talk. But I want to focus specifically on this data center operations issue, where you have unavoidable insider threats. You cannot make them go away. You can't operate computers without people. And as you said, they can be managed. Is there a way that end-to-end encryption can help make the downside from insider abuse less of a trust issue for the general public? It's a question for you to answer, if you can.
Okay, so first, we don't have to discuss it now, but I'm dubious of the claim that we can fix the malware issue. Sounds good. I think you're asking a pretty large question, which is how do we convince the public of that? And that could be, this crowd. Okay. Well, at the end of the day, the idea of the end-to-end verifiable systems is that an insider attack would be detected, because everything that has an impact on the outcome of the election is published along with mathematical proofs. So you publish all of the encrypted votes, and the voters can each verify that their receipt still matches. Or if they don't want to do any work, they can pass off their receipt to their political party or their organization of choice, and they can do that. And then the tallying, whether it's mixing or whether it's homomorphic tallying or whatever the method is, all involves publications of every single step, all the ciphertext, all the proofs involved in every manipulation. And what you would then have is every political organization that has even a little bit of money would be able to download that data, run the program of their choice by the supplier of their choice to verify all of that. So it doesn't mean that the insiders are magically unable to do anything. It just means that if they do, there's going to be a whole bunch of people watching who can detect that change. That's why I think it is solvable by having a lot of barking dogs ready to shout whenever there's a problem, or bark whenever there's a problem.
And Eric Lazarus, and I'm up for doing the threat models on that so I can understand how the ballot box stuffing and stuff is prevented and other stuff like that. I guess I'm interested in understanding kind of other people's perspective on the political reality. I guess I have a very basic idea that democracy only works when experts speak very clearly to the non-experts. People can't be experts in everything. If we believe that internet voting is incredibly dangerous, people in this room need to be very consistent about saying that and saying it very clearly. And so, Ben's point, while it sounds very persuasive, I wonder whether what they say about the opposite of a wise idea is often another wise idea. So I wanted to get people's thoughts about political reality and how we ought to be treating it.
I guess I just have one thought, which is, not one, I've got a lot of thoughts on this, but one I'll mention. The situation in Estonia now is rather tricky because they've held several elections on a system which many people are saying is insecure. For the government to acknowledge that it was insecure, you can imagine it would create a lot of doubt about the outcome of the previous elections. So it will certainly be harder if we go ahead and institute internet voting in the United States, and then some of us show it's insecure, what happens then? I mean, it's going to be a mess. And so I guess, I share some of Ben's fears, I think that we should continue fighting against having an insecure system put in place.
I'll add the following detail to that. We're relying right now on two aspects of voting. When we push as activists in general, we say no internet and paper. And I think both of those are going to be a huge challenge for the kids today who do everything on the internet and nothing on paper. And we have to realize what that means. We're basically saying voting is completely different from everything else you do in life. And I actually agree with that. I think there's something very unique about voting, very unique about the voting threat model that makes it different from everything else we do. But I think we are very much failing at convincing the general population of that. I don't think we need a backup plan, I think.
Okay, Peter Neumann, SRI, once again. I'm going to put on my hat as the designated holist, which I sometimes do, and look at this as a total system problem. Ron's heard me do this many times before, and most of you in the room probably have. But the existing metaphor is sort of the cloud computing where you're trusting untrustworthy third parties that you don't even know exist. And the alternative is some sort of a system architecture, which some of the software independence and some of the other efforts, some of the crypto stuff, does try to address. And that is, you'd like to build a system and network and everything else in which you have minimized the amount of stuff you have to trust. And what we have today is something where essentially everything is a potential source of vulnerabilities. Now, the architecture that one would like to see is one in which we only have to trust a few very, very carefully designed pieces, which can be in some way either formally verified or vetted extensively, and where the architecture itself is inherently sound. The problem comes from the fact that we're trying to solve a bunch of problems at the same time, one of which is the insider problem, which was just mentioned, another of which is the denial of service problem, which has not really been considered, usability, administrability, operability, and the 70-year-old poll workers who don't understand technology, don't understand procedure, don't understand all of the exception conditions that may arise. To make a long story short, I think what we've got here is a situation, I've said before, we like to think of strength and depth and breadth. What we have today is weakness in breadth and depth. And what we really need is architectures, total system architectures, including all of the people, vulnerabilities, including the things like the denial of service attacks, which can render an entire precinct essentially messed up in a way that cannot be understood because there's no audit trail, for example. And the bottom line here is, unless we really have the transparency and the understandability of the entire process, we are failing. So from the research community's point of view, the system concept of looking at the entire system, including all of the people and all of the possible things they can do wrong, including the fact that you are necessarily trusting vendors who may not be trustworthy. All of this has to be wrapped together. And I can go on for a great length, but I think I've gotten the point across that this is a total system problem that is unlike a lot of other total system problems in the sense that the set of requirements that we need to be able to enforce is much larger than a lot of the standard, say, cloud computing kinds of things that, that people come up with. So unless we are able to address all of those issues and not just push some of them down and say, well, we can't deal with denial of service, we can't deal with insiders, except we can put a wrapper around them and make sure that they're doing something that's detectable. Unless we can do that kind of stuff, we are failing.
I feel strongly about what you just said in a positive way, and I know of only two approaches to solve very large system problems like that involve technology and involve systems. One of them is extremely expensive and sort of NASA/military style, enormous project, hardcore project management, top-down design. We don't have anywhere near the budget to do that kind of stuff in this field. The other approach is the bottom-up, open-source-inspired approach of building a small system, iterating, throwing away pieces, tacking them on, etc., in a public way with public observability. And whether it's with Helios or with a whole bunch of other systems, I think that's the only way we have a chance of building a common system that works, because we definitely don't have the ability to do the other approach.
If I can just add one quick comment. There's also the issue of archaic laws. I mean, as we saw in Florida with the 12-day interval between the end of the election and certifying it, we are not. It's not. I know we're not politicians. It's not our role to go out and change laws, but we have to somehow convince policymakers that we need to have legislation which is commensurate with the technologies so that we can, in fact, implement more secure, more encompassing technologies that we'll feel more comfortable with. I mean, what I've been amazed with since starting to work in this area is how archaic our entire voting system is, and I think this, the discussion, the talk from South Carolina just reemphasized that.
Dan Wallach, Rice University. I wanted to address the concern of bribery and coercion, which hasn't really come up, which I find surprising for an internet voting panel, because it's a traditional issue with any kind of, once you get rid of a voting booth, bribery and coercion becomes a problem. And I was the Estonian solution is that you get to cast multiple votes, the last one overriding the previous, which seems like a nice approach because then you can sell your vote as many times as you want and then cast your proper vote. But that seems to conflict with an EDE scheme because any possible receipt token-like object you have could be used to ensure that you didn't cast a subsequent overriding vote. So I'm curious if you guys have thought about how you could build bribery / coercion resistance into an E2E scheme or any other internet scheme.
Well, I can say how we're trying to do it. Obviously, the voter in our system gets a return code. However, we still maintain that this is receipt freeness because it is not a receipt. It is a proof that this instance of the vote was recorded as cast. The coercer doesn't know if that's your final vote. In fact, as a voter, I may even have gone to a polling station and cast an advance paper vote. And I will know that that's the vote that will be counted because paper votes always win.
So in your scheme, you can actually collect from each party.
Yep. We tend to refer to it as a great system for vote selling and a terrible system for vote buying. Because you have to be really stupid to buy votes.
Can I challenge that a little bit? The only reason that works, I think, is because you're not providing the second half of end-to-end verifiability, which is that you're not letting the public verify the receipts all the way to the tally, right?
Correct.
If you did provide that link, then that would go away,
I think. That's correct. Okay. That's correct. So, now, I could just add that because of the way the voter is allowed to manipulate the ballot, you would actually, it's very easy to craft a ballot that in itself is a receipt. Right. So that's why we can't show it. It has nothing to do with the return code.
Gotcha. So one point of information, Ari Jules has a scheme which assumes that at registration time you register in secret and you're given a real voting key and a bunch of fake voting keys. And that way you can cast a bunch of votes, some of which are fake, one of which is real, and the coercers don't know which one is which. I'm just saying that folks have explored this solution, and I think there's quite a bit more that could be done to make them more usable. But at the end of the day, you still require that one moment of privacy. You just need it at registration time rather than vote casting time.
Pam Smith, Verified Voting. So I get troubled by the use of this term inevitable because I think there's corresponding terms that also start with I, like infeasible and impossible and inadvisable and so on. And I imprudent, yeah. We were told back in around 2004, which isn't so very long ago, I mean, we were all using ATMs back then, that everyone was going to vote on DREs, and as it turned out, that didn't happen. We were able to sort of stem that tide, and I think because we gave people opportunity to think about what was involved and what might be perhaps a better solution. That comes to mind when I hear the term inevitable, and I think that it bears mentioning. And just because there's a cliff doesn't mean we have to drive top speed off of it. At minimum, I think that the recommendations that were in the computer technologist statement on internet voting still hold, which is that this sort of thing shouldn't happen without informed public discussion. What I've seen with the public so far is that when they realize what's involved, when they learn more about it, even when you just sometimes ask them, how do you know your vote was counted, they tend to go, oh, and think more about it rather than just say, oh, that'll be fun and easy. So those are my thoughts. Thanks.
All right. So what I love about panels is conflict. I love for panelists to be at each other's throats. But if you're not going to be at each other's throats, maybe you can be at mine. So I'd like to play devil's advocate for a second. So imagine that nobody had invented E to E math, right? We didn't know any of the crypto. We didn't know how to do any kind of remote voting or verifiable voting in that way. And so the best option that we knew how to do was just paper, right? We could tell people that if they want to vote securely, they will need to go to a polling place, they will need to cast their vote, drop it in the ballot box, make sure that representatives of their party watch that ballot box as it goes to headquarters, that gets counted, and then we know how everything happens. If that were the story, then it would be much easier to message with people who are looking to implement internet voting, because we could tell them a very simple answer, which is that there's absolutely no way to do any kind of secure remote voting. Anybody who tells you otherwise is wrong. And in fact, we should not allow people to vote over the internet. We should not allow people to vote by mail. We should have polling places. We should do things with paper in this very simple way. So in other words, the existence of E2E as another possibility complicates the messaging in a way that allows confusion, accidental or deliberate. Would it be better, given those admittedly devil's advocate sort of facts, to pretend in talking with certain people that E2E doesn't exist?
I think that the acronym that's got everybody optimistic about internet voting is SSL. So when we started using that, we felt that that was the sort of black magic that made the entire thing super duper safe. And just about nobody understands the difference between e-banking and e-voting. And I feel like the genie's out of the bottle. I'm glad E2E exists, but I wish it had existed earlier and we'd been able to get it out there.
I have a similar perspective, actually. It would be a lot easier without the E2E message also being disseminated. I personally think that the best kind of voting is polling place voting, as you describe, with things being done properly. Not as, for example, they are done in some states where they botch things up with paper. And in fact, I'm disturbed even by the move to vote by mail, which is going on in a lot of the country, because the vote by mail, again, opens up the system to coercion, vote buying and selling, and fraud. So I think polling place voting is the best system that's ever been invented. I wish we could stick with it, except for cases where we obviously can't use it, for people who are sick and so on. But that's not what we have now.
As much as I would love to say that E2E voting understanding is so widespread that it's causing people to declare that internet voting is obviously safe, I don't think it has any measurable impact on people's desire for internet voting. And to go back to Pam's point, I think the main reason why I say inevitable, which of course is a strong word, is that there's a big change. When people went from voting with DREs back to voting with paper, it didn't change their voting process that much. They still showed up at the polling place, they had a slightly different machine, and they probably liked it better because there was paper involved that they could get a receipt on. Voting over the internet is going to be a lot more convenient for people. And I think the idea of explaining to them that, no, now they have to go back to the polling place is a much, much harder battle. So maybe I'm wrong. Maybe it's not inevitable and maybe it's worth fighting for. But in that case, it's a battle that's probably 10 times harder at least.
Duncan Buell from South Carolina. I have to do this. I went to a NASA conference. Nice that you mentioned NASA. They did invent this whole question of how you do big systems and get it right when you have a one-time event with no do-over. As my father explained once, when the satellite goes bad, it's a $100 million house call for the plumber. I went to a NASA conference, and the guy from Morton Thiokol, who had been vilified and sent to the American equivalent of digging ditches in Urumqi during the Cultural Revolution, spoke on the Challenger. And it was his career had been brought back to life by Feynman's papers. And he talked about the meetings with all the engineers in Salt Lake the night before the Challenger, and the emails back and forth, you know, do not launch if it goes below 27 degrees, do not launch if it goes below 27 degrees. And his lesson to that crowd was, if it really matters, then the technical people have to exercise a voice that may be different from the fairness and all the caveats that you do when you publish academic papers. If you've ever done expert witnessing, the lawyers will always tell you, don't talk like a professor. You've got to be absolutely dead certain you're right. We have a responsibility, if we really believe it's a bad idea, to express the fact that we think it's a bad idea. If it is a great idea, fine. But if it's a bad idea, we have a responsibility to do what we think we're the experts in.
I'm going to stick with my controversial position since it's much more fun that way. And obviously, I hope people understand that this is a little bit more extreme than what I actually think, but I think it's important to discuss. We're not trying to convince the space shuttle launch team. We're trying to convince everybody in the United States who's voting, and I think that's much, much harder. And also, it would be better if we could take every voter, sit them down for half an hour, and explain to them the issues that they're voting on. That would also be a lot better, I think, for democracy if people were more informed when they voted. I don't think it's going to happen. So when I say this, I really do think that there's some amount of just this an unbelievable force that's happening yes, it would be nice if we could have more informed citizens all voting in private, leaving all their cell phones at the door so they're not YouTubing their vote and all that good stuff, right? I'm pessimistic.
Actually, to be slightly more optimistic than you are, we don't have to convince everybody. We just have to convince the members of Congress to pass a bill saying that we will not have insecure internet voting. Now, that doesn't sound like an easy task, but it sounds like an easier task than the one you were just outlining.
Eva Waskow, independent election integrity activist. I'd like to follow up on something that Peter said, and I totally agree with Pam Smith about the inevitability, systems thinking. We have not come close to having integrity and completeness in a debate about the insider issue in our present elections. Now, magnify that a quantum leap when you're talking about key management, which I haven't heard a lot of discussion about here, and you guys are the experts, I just know it's a key issue, but the key management issue in an internet system which needs to be solved is horrendous. The other thing that was mentioned here, and Dana mentioned it too, that, you know, it's just inevitable. These kids have been coming up with iPads and iPhones and I this and I that. Convenience. I have heard 25 years of the driving forces being verbally, policy-wise, and funding-wise, convenience, 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 which I think has contributed in large part to where we are now. I don't have the answer to this, but I suggest that Sherry Turkle's new book, who's an MIT lady, who's been looking at very closely the issue how technology, the constant use, is changing the brain and use function. Perhaps she needs to do a chapter, or one of you can, you know, suggest that she really do a chapter and look at the implications of catering to convenience in this particular area of elections. And perhaps it is that Barbara says that the going back to the paper, even if it becomes a nostalgic thing, that needs to be looked into. I don't have the answer, but Sherry Turkle's book needs to, I think, is very relevant to this conversation.
From Seattle, and well, I'm new at this business. Well, I've been there for 2 years and a half, but I think that I'm still very new at this. And I have some doubts about how this works, because I see that we have clients that push us with security or usability requirements or functionalities. Then the academics or the researchers also have the requirements. We may also have our security requirements, but I don't know how we can put these all together to be to have a common idea, because maybe we can sell a system that is not as secure as we want it, but the client wants it, or maybe the client doesn't need to follow what the researchers say. So I think this is not good, and I would like to know what do you think that we could do to achieve this. I don't know, that a level of security that benefits everyone, and if we should make standards mandatory or something like that.
I think the transparency would be the first hill to climb. I think that if you do research, that's great. And you do come up with a new protocol, great. But really, the whole process of its deployment and implementation and configuration and whatnot needs to be an open book. And then people will be able to make independent assessments about security.
Yeah, I'd almost say stop using salespeople. salespeople. I've been through a one-year procurement process with CITL, which CITL eventually won, but it was a long fight to get through the salespeople insisting that their existing system was secure because the applet was signed and there was SSL, right?
I'm not from the sales team.
No, exactly. Sandra is very good. And bring in people like you a lot earlier, I think that'll help a lot. Just a thought.
I really want to thank you for making that remark a moment ago about transparency, because a lot of us have heard this before, but I wanted to point out something that election officials, including some that are at this conference or at the EBT conferences, people that we know and their colleagues, are work that they're already doing to try to forestall what I think is the reason for eventual adoption of internet voting that I really hate the most. And I guarantee you, I know some of the people that will be in state houses 10, 20, 30, 40 years from now making decisions about whether to move to remote voting over the internet. And one of the reasons that they might do it is because the election system at that time is untransparent, crazy, full of unreliable legacy technology, and election officials don't have enough money to even show you how they conducted their election well. That would be from these people who I know, they're my teenage son's peers, okay, for them to just chuck the whole kit and caboodle and do it on our phones, because it couldn't be any worse. All right. So I worry like Pam about inevitability, and I don't believe it, but I worry about it. I just want to call attention that some of the ordinary, less high-tech, wonderful stuff that we do in the election integrity community and the work that election officials do to try to make their processes more rationalized, more open, the ability to conduct the type of audits that Phil was talking about. That was a huge pile of work that Phil was talking about, just to say, hey, I have enough evidence that we did everything right so that you could actually audit the election, right? A lot of that is impeded by current technology, it's impeded by current law, it's impeded by current lack of funding, and we're all working to try to overcome that. But that is a way, at least, to raise the bar for transparent, effective, high-integrity elections to the point where 30 years from now, when my buddy Pat is in the California State House, he might actually consider keeping, in-person voting, because there might be a reason to respect it. And that's a lot of work that we have to do. Fortunately, I think we do have the years to do it. So I'm a little hopeful on that regard. So thanks very much for that note.
Hi, Jim Soper. Couple of comments, mostly around the concept of a meltdown. I think, first of all, when a number of us grew up, we were told that atomic power was inevitable. And it's around, but it's not around as much as that we thought it would be. And gee, we just had a meltdown in Japan, and countries are pulling back. In this country, we really would have two kinds of meltdowns. One, which is the predictable, the whole system crashes because of an attack from outside or an insider attack, but everything goes wrong, and yeah, you detect that something went wrong, but you have no method for recovery. And there you have a big problem. And then the other thing that I don't think he has so much in Australia and Norway is we would have a second kind of meltdown. Presidential vote decided by 300 votes. 527, whatever. I mean, we see this over and over. They had a close senator race in Minnesota, and the lawsuits and so on. If we have a close election on the internet, they're going to be fighting over that. And that's going to be a big problem by itself. And so I just wanted to throw in a mention of a second kind of meltdown that we would have in this country. Thank you.
Well, I mean, as I said, in Estonia, there are people who are questioning the results of the internet election there. So I think that's unhealthy for any democracy. I just have to say, for my own part, what I find really hard to fathom is that people on the one hand will read about all of these break-ins at Google and in the government and everywhere and see and read about how incredibly insecure the internet is on the one hand, and then on the other hand think that voting by attaching your ballot to an email and sending it in is okay. In fact, some people say that's not the internet. I've heard that said, that the email is not internet voting, so why are you worried? I mean, really, one of the members of the Washington State Legislature said it's not internet voting. So this is the sort of thing that we have to worry about.
So I think it's a good point. I didn't mention that after the inevitable internet voting, maybe we will have a meltdown, right? Maybe we will have a drastically bad thrown election, evidence of malware. That shows that this happened, and maybe that would cause us to backtrack. And I can see the argument for saying, well, maybe we should let that happen. I don't know. I'm not so sure about that. That's why I'm thinking maybe we should try to secure it so we reduce that possibility. But I do think that if it's inevitable that we have internet voting, it's certainly possible that we have a gigantic meltdown after that.
Yeah. Hi, I just want to float the idea of a kind of a meta-democracy. So you have democracy about the democratic process, and that is to say, if everybody wants internet voting, just give it to them. And then, you know, maybe if it turns out to be tyrannical, then people can come and reclaim after
the rum session was yesterday.
You know, if you go back all the way to the beginning, right? If you go back all the way to the beginning, right? You know, people, the ancient Athenian democracy started out of people being upset with how things were, and then they said, "Cleisthenes, give us something better," and then he did. So, you know, maybe we need to reach that point first. So I don't know what you think about that.
So I have a question for the panel. Does Norway think, does Estonia think, does Australia think, does anyone think that a nation state which wanted to attack an internet election would not succeed?
Good question.
But would it be detected?
Detected may be irrelevant.
Of course, it's not enough to detect it. You have to correct it, right? Or you have to abandon the election and rerun it. Do you think, does anybody think that if China wished to attack any internet election that we might envision today, that they could not succeed?
No. that's very important to point out that unlike Estonia, we are in no way saying internet voting for everyone right now. Internet voting, I don't get to opine because I'm just a bureaucrat, but I think the lines we're working along is that internet voting might be a useful supplement to paper voting. there is a case to be made in certain cases that internet voting may add something.
Well, he said that he believed that China would succeed.
Absolutely.
Without detection.
I don't think so. Not without detection. And that's where you say, okay, so you have no way of rectifying it. In Norway, the response would be, well, yes, we'd rerun the race, and probably on paper.
How long after the president takes office do you...
Exactly. Yeah, it's an entirely different problem, right? When you're talking about a U.S. presidential race and you're saying everyone should be voting on the internet, then no one in their right mind, I think, would be advocating that.
I think they would succeed, and they would do it with an internet worm like approach for best possible deniability of the approach, and probably we would detect it. You know, Stuxnet was eventually detected. Someone would detect it. I'm not saying that's good enough. I'm just saying I think it would be detected. I don't know when. With the technologies we have today, I don't see how we can do that.
One of the slides I didn't have time to show you guys, which was our experience with the return codes. 80% of voters checked their return codes. 80%, yes. We were hugely surprised.
I think somebody hacked your logs.
Well, in fact... I mean, we were hugely surprised by that number. It may be just curiosity because it's the first time, but because we'd expected, you know, single digits percentage.
I just want to throw out the point that, of course, you know, obviously it doesn't matter if everyone is voting on the internet. If enough people or enough votes are coming in, rather, from the internet, that it changes the mark, that it's, you know, bigger than the margin, then it, you know, doesn't really matter how many, you know, that it isn't everyone.
No, and I want to follow up on that because not every country in the world has presidential elections decided by 535 or whatever votes.
No, we're special.
Yeah, well, you are. That's one point. And actually, you need to look at the risks in every country needs to make their own decision. And there was something else I was going to say, but my blood sugar is getting low.
As an election official, again, I would make the comment. I was just going to pass on the comment about the whole meltdown issue, which is that based on my experience, county budgets, you're expected to take 10% cuts every year until there is a meltdown. And then all of a sudden, you get all the money you need. So I'm not sure how that's relevant to this discussion, but I thought I'd point it out. It's sort of a theoretical question. I'm not sure I'm asking it to anybody, but just putting it out there is what privacy being one of the high values that we all share about the characteristics of an election. But I'm wondering about what any thoughts you might have about the quote unquote the younger generation, the folk who are using Facebook and exposing all of their secrets to the entire world. What is that going to have? How is that going to impact the notion of privacy?
They're going to be sorry.
I would say if you read some of the more recent literature on privacy in teens, I think it turns out they really do care about privacy. They just express it and manage their privacy in very different ways than the older folks, I guess. So if you're interested, I recommend reading Dana Boyd on this topic. She has some... Dana Boyd, B-O-Y-D. She has some fantastic research of how teens manage their privacy.
What I'm gathering from this conversation is that as horrified as we all seem to be about the prospects of internet voting, I am afraid that it's inevitable. And if that's true, then maybe what we need to do is reframe the question into how can we solve these problems, not how can we say no.
I mean, one of the things that really worries me is that someone's going to make an iPhone app, right? And it'll be for voting for someone important. and it'll be all done on iPhones. It'll completely step over us, and it'll...
That's certainly possible. Maybe one of the first steps is to start convincing the hardware manufacturers that something has to go in the bottom of the hardware that could support a trusted computing platform. I don't know that we have any real clue what that might be yet, but I'm not sure that we could solve this problem without it.
So about... About 8 years ago, I guess now, Ted Selker, who was at the MIT Caltech Voting Technology Project, suggested a kind of voting he called Xbox voting, or because the Xbox was the most widespread trusted computing base out there, and the voting process would go something like, you go to the store the night before the elections, you pick three Xboxes off the shelf, you know, that's your cut and choose approach to make sure that you're getting machines that are proper, and you run election software based on that. And if you look at the various trusted computing bases we have, whether it's Xbox or PlayStation or iPhones, iPads, I think this is a worthwhile exploration down the path of, if it's inevitable, what do we do to limit the problems? It doesn't eliminate them. The folks with the signing keys at Apple can still issue different other software.
But
I think it's certainly a worthwhile thing. The whole idea of like commodity trusted computing bases could significantly reduce the risk, as weird as that is to combine that with an open source system.
Harry Hurst, just a quick question, because now there must be something I didn't connect the dots right. So in Norwegian system, you have the mail-in paper, behind of which is the set of codes. You vote, system goes to the server, your vote goes to the server, another server generates you text message, you get the text message, you compare it with the paper, you call if you see problem, right? You said, do you know that 80% check the receipt? How do you know that?
How do I know that? Well, obviously, I don't know if 80% in this election are going to do so. I know from, two sources. One, polling. We have done 10 pre-pilots, small scale, two of which included the return codes. And so we had a regular phone poll, which gave that response. Now, in one of the municipalities, I actually drove around that municipality on election day, because we also had electronic voting in polling stations for that day. And I asked every voter I could run into on the street, did you check your return code? The number was the same, 80%.
That's great, because that is exactly what I expected the answer, because we did one of the VVPAT studies where the voter voted, the VVPAT was on the side, and then we asked, did you check it? We got almost 100% said they check it. Every single one was wrong. Because the VVPAT, not the single correct VVPAT, was ever created.
Yeah, thank you. That's the whole issue of non-opinions and answering whatever they think is expected of you. That's a methodical problem, obviously. We have some research design going on to try and do this in a controlled environment with proper test subjects and all. Sure. So we just haven't gotten around to that yet. It's part of the evaluation that's planned for next year.
David Jefferson again. Somebody mentioned privacy on the panel, and that triggered the following thought, which is that in my experience, every technical innovation in voting has led to an erosion of vote privacy, net erosion of vote privacy. And this is another innovation, the internet voting forms that we might consider. And I'm concerned that there is no end-to-end test for loss of privacy in balloting. And what does the panel think about the dangers of the erosion of vote privacy with the various kinds of internet voting systems that might be proposed?
You mean over and above just the loss of privacy with remote voting? Because you lose privacy there too.
Well, aren't we talking about remote voting?
Any kind of remote voting.
Beyond mail.
The mail voting problem?
Yes, but yes, beyond mail voting, sorry, yes.
Well, Personally, I think that the male in Val is probably the worst. I think compared to a remote electronic voting system where you have re-voting options, I think actually the mail-in ballot is the worst of the lot.
You don't think that the attacks on mail-in ballots are retail, and that there's an insider could do an enormous
for mail-in ballots? Yes, absolutely. I think they're terrible.
Well, I didn't say they weren't terrible. I'm just asking whether the electronic remote voting is even worse.
No, I don't think so.
Okay.
I think actually I think the mail-in ballot is the worst.
For privacy, you think it's the worst?
For privacy, for coercion, privacy in the home, right? There's the family voting issue.
I'm thinking about automated attacks on the privacy of a large number of electronic
That's true.
We have eyeballs. We can actually see people opening envelopes, separating the privacy sleeve. I mean,
there's
so
a difference.
Have some
of
reason to believe that they might actually be maintaining privacy.
We're thinking about different of privacy in different terms. Yeah, there are two dimensions: the privacy from the authorities and the privacy from your immediate surroundings when you're casting your ballot. Right, and the mail-in ballot doesn't allow you to re-vote, so. Anyone could be looking over your shoulder as you're casting it, and there's no way to change it after the fact. That's the point.
Anyway,
You can actually re-vote in the U.S. at least when you do a mail-in ballot. You can come in and override your vote.
It depends on the jurisdiction.
Yeah.
Sorry. That's true. So, okay, fair enough. I just stepped into dangerous territory here. My sense is that the re-voting stuff, I'd love to see some more stats on it. In theory, it's very interesting. In practice, I wonder if voters understand the concept of re-voting. I get users all the time who ask me to turn it off on Helios. Just like, stop. I only want voters to vote once. And I explain to them it's a security feature. You can vote more than once. If you're not happy, you can try again until you're happy. And no, they want it turned off. So I think in practice, it might confuse users. If you're talking about attacks, David, attacks on the system, then yes, there's potential erosion of privacy in a large-scale attack. The same kind of attack that would alter the vote could be an attack on voter privacy, although honestly, I don't see China having any interest in doing the attack on privacy.
But there's no detection. There needn't be any detection.
That's right. That would be much harder to detect, but I think the incentives there are a lot weirder to, it's violating it's almost like it's declining incentive. Violating a million voters' privacy is okay, so everybody got screwed, right? But violating a few key people's privacy, that could be potentially interesting.
It's not actually very hard to. I mean, if I were a political party, I would very much like to know how is. If we're thinking about advanced voting over a time period, like we're doing in Norway for a month, then I would very much like to know how are people voting, because that would allow me to change my strategy.
Right.
So yes, it's a real issue. I've said this many times, obviously not to you guys, but this is a real problem. It's one we cannot solve. I have no solution for it. If you're voting on the internet, sorry, I cannot guarantee your privacy.
So the one quick point I was getting at is that in the attacks, I think there are weaknesses, but I have trouble seeing the incentives lining up for large-scale privacy violations by way of attack. I don't think there's inherent privacy erosion in internet voting systems if you use proper data hygiene techniques, things related to end-to-end voting, where you're not creating a whole bunch of privacy-violating data in one place. So I don't think inherently, although of course if the attacks are there, then that's an avenue for erosion of privacy.
In quick response to that, I can imagine several scenarios. I think it would be an awesome terrorist attack if you gave Americans the feeling that there is no secret ballot, that it could potentially injure democracy for a generation or two. That could be massive. Plus, if you just had the ability to find a few hundred key people who you could blackmail because they turn out to have unpopular votes, I could probably think of more if I did some threat modeling around this. But I really want to just leave people with a thought about this. What would we want earthquake engineers to do in the analogous case? So imagine they lived in a country where people were hell-bent to build earthquake-unsafe buildings. would we want them to just keep hammering away saying, that's not good enough, that's going to fall down, that's not good enough? Or would we want them to say, oh, well, give me the budget, I'll do the best I can, I think it'll fall down, people will die, but, you know, I'm not going to make too much of a stink. I'll tell you which one I would want them to do. Even if they're going to lose, I want them to keep hammering away and say, well, maybe you'll listen to me next generation. That's what I would want them to do. It's a thought.
The difference there is that only if, and there's an analogy that Josh hasn't brought up yet, but he brought it up. Do you want to bring it up now, maybe?
I'm sure, I'm happy to. It'd be incendiary, but okay. Well, I've got to, yeah. Fine. I'll mention that a few of the people in this room were at a retreat workshop in Dachstuhl, Germany last month, and a very similar debate that's been had here developed, and we finally realized what was going on. The two sides were developing, and it was Paul Gibson that brought up the analogy of the debate that we were having, and the analogy was that. The places where internet voting is being done now and being proposed and what we see is like playing Russian roulette with a gun with five bullets in six chambers. And Hovav did mention when I brought this up that, but the gun isn't pointed at your own head. It's pointed at somebody else's. but the debate was that we felt that the technology community had the ability to remove three or four of the bullets. So given that, should we do what we can to make it as safe as possible, given that this person is determined to play the game? Or should we just keep on saying, no, don't do it, no, don't do it, I won't be a part of it, even though it seems like it's going to happen without us? And the question for the panelists is, do you agree with that analogy? And if so, what side do you take, or why do you disagree with
it? The answer is you need to do both.
Well, maybe some of us do one, some of us do the other.
So. I think the common point between these two analogies, the reason I wanted you to bring it up, is that in both of those analogies, we're thinking of the folks with the gun or the folks building houses on the earthquake-prone zone as the other. There's a few people over there. They're going to get screwed if they do the wrong thing. Oh, well, too bad. At least I'm not in trouble, right? Because my house isn't on the earthquake fault. In that analogy, it's not like everybody's in earthquake zone. In the analogy with the gun, it's not like everyone's got a gun to their head. But I think that's what we're dealing with. We're talking about everyone doing internet voting. So the analogy is about if you think everyone's going to do it, including you, because, you know, like, it's your country too, right? It's your election for your country. Then how does that change your perspective? If it seems like it's inevitable, but it doesn't just affect the subset of people who want to take the risk, it affects the entire population. I think that changes the equation a little bit. Maybe I'm not being clear because you.
So you're saying in a country where every building was being built in an earthquake unsafe way, you'd want the earthquake engineers to do what? I want them to keep ringing the bell and saying, "Hey, we're all living in incredibly unsafe buildings. We should stop that."
Okay, right? Yeah, but let's assume that they're moving your house too. At which point do you say, okay, well, can you at least strengthen the house, please? Because it's my house now and I don't want it to collapse on me.
I certainly wouldn't want them to pretend that the buildings aren't going to fall down. They might say, okay, given the limited budget you're giving me, this is the best I can do, and it sucks. And they should be really, really clear, no? I mean, even if they are doing the best they can with a limited budget.
I agree. I don't think we should be hiding the issue or sweeping it under the rug in any way. I definitely don't think that. But I think we have to be careful in these analogies to think that it's just the other that's going to get in trouble. It's all of us. We're all in the same boat, right? Yeah, I know. It's just the analogies might lead us down.
Right. I mean, even if we didn't vote over the internet, if enough people did, it wouldn't matter because it's the election. It's not that I need to have my vote recorded correctly. I need to have the election outcome be correct. Really?
Better said than what I said yesterday.
So I would fight it.
Please.
Hi. Sorry, I'm really nervous. I don't like talking in front of a lot of people, and I'm very new to this. You guys actually kind of touched on a lot of the stuff that I was going to say or ask about. Ariane from UBC. I just kind of wanted to ask, it affects everybody, especially in very close elections like you have here in the States. But what about in cases where there's not usually that small of a margin and asking people who are pro-internet voting, even that they know the risk, whether they're willing to take that risk for the benefit of being able to participate in a democratic election.
But under what scenario would you have to vote over the internet in order to participate?
Everybody who lives overseas.
There are other ways of doing it.
Yeah, there are. But
like sending the ballot to them electronically and having them mail it in, for example.
But I know there's lots of people who try to, and despite their best efforts, it's very, very hard to, like things don't get mailed properly. I know I have sent lots of things that don't end up getting to the people that they're supposed to. And this would seem to be a better assurance for them that their vote was counted rather than assuming that their mail got in at a certain place.
Well, okay, go ahead.
I think what you were saying is, can we try it in places where the risk of damage is less, right?
Yeah.
Am I interpreting that correctly?
Yeah,
where the margin of victory is usually larger, where even if there's a little bit of corruption, it's probably not going to affect the outcome. I think yes, but I don't know where. Yes, it would be nice, but I don't know where that would be. Maybe smaller countries. There's some developments in Israel that has a simpler voting system where they just vote for one party and that's it. So you could simplify the voting system. Huh? No, sorry, one party out of a few choices. Yes, the dictatorial voting system is. Yeah. So if we can do it in simpler areas, it would be nice too. It's yes.
Okay.
But then again, of course, you have the risk of the slippery slope, which we've all been talking about, and of course, which is what I view Estonia as being to some extent, that it's held up as an example of how this can be done, how internet voting can be done, which is why I wanted to emphasize the fact that what they're doing in Estonia is insecure.
The challenge there would be divided competition, so you look at and have a 80 to 20 reversed and become 20 to 80. Mm-hmm. Would that make you happy?
Sorry, I had also one more question about, so no one else has, I don't exactly know anything about the security. I know it's probably very, very low of SMS voting, but that's the kind of thing that gets asked about a lot. And is there any way of minimizing the effect of that kind of thing that's a very insecure system, but like limits the amount of impact that any attack can do by spreading things out? Because I know I'm interested in developing communities too. Voting in person is also very risky. It's not secure at all. And so how we're using paper ballots as the epitome of security and voter privacy, maybe if you had the chance to vote on a personal device in the privacy of your own home in the middle of the night, that would actually be better for security.
It would be in Northern Ireland. Turning up to vote in Northern Ireland, get you shot.
So the main difference there, and I think I'll join a bunch of my other panelists, is the difference between a retail and a wholesale attack.
Mm-hmm.
There's basically four mobile providers in the US, and between the four of them, they see and can modify and read every SMS that's sent. So by controlling a few points, you can control the entire election. And on paper, in a distributed setting, it would be much harder to have that same kind of effect that one mobile provider could have. So that's usually the argument that I think a lot of experts generally agree on, between the retail attacks that require huge deployment of attackers versus wholesale that just can have attack one choke point.
Did you say you're at UBC?
Yeah.
You're talking about Canadian elections where you can't? I'm sorry, maybe I don't know what UBC you're at. Where are you?
Yeah, in Vancouver.
In Vancouver?
Yeah.
So you're talking about Canadian elections?
Not just Canadian elections, but African elections, okay. Iranian elections, Filipino.
Okay. I was wondering what you were saying about Canada.
Because I just noticed that there's been very little discussion on that end of the thing. It's been very American-centric, and it's kind of classist a little bit, because these really nitty-gritty issues and all these keys and all these things, like, you know, we would love to have something just somewhat auditable or somewhat safe in a lot of countries in the world.
Okay.
I don't know. Hopefully next year there might be more input in that end.
I think there's more chance for trying new things, which can be both good and bad, in countries that don't have as complicated an approach as the U.S. So, like I said, there's some trials of end-to-end verifiable voting in Israel because the voting process is simpler, more centralized, fewer people. All these things make those experiments easier to perform. And I'll be quiet now. Sorry.
Okay.
Thank you.
It's a question of whether you want to do these experiments or not. I mean, if we're going to oppose end-to-end voting and pretend it doesn't exist and make a whole lot of noise, then there'll be no experiments and there'll be no lessons learned and no bootstrapping and nothing will get any better. And this is what I'm worried about personally.
But, of course, one of the issues with experiments or pilot projects with internet voting is how do you know if it was successful or not? It might be one thing to say everybody liked it, but you have no way of knowing if the results were correct.
Well, in places like Canada and the U.S., there's lots and lots of public, or there's lots and lots of polls done, and a lot of times they're, you know, they can be fairly accurate.
Are you going to assume that the polls are correct?
No, no. But I mean, if there's a major, major discrepancy, then
and then what? The election's over.
I don't know.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
You have a riot?
Okay. I'm going to pause things for just a moment because it's 5 o'clock. We've gone well over our allotted time, but it's okay. We have some flexibility in the schedule, and you know, we're okay. okay. If you have to run, absolutely. I now understand why I was asked to chair this panel. It was to keep me away from the microphone because I've got burning questions that I would love to ask the panelists, and nobody seems to be asking. But I think, you know, if it's okay with everybody, we can go on maybe a little bit further. I think, Ben, you might have to. Or I'll tell you, if you're running, maybe I'll ask you okay. One question, if you'll allow me. I was very surprised at your slide when you said that we have no idea of what to do about client security, because, of course, Helios does allow you to at least detect if your client is compromised. It doesn't guarantee that your vote will get through if your client is compromised, but you can at least tell. Is that true?
Yeah. Yes, I was a little bit quick on that point. Let me try to be a little more precise. There are a number of cryptographic techniques, and those in Helios are drawn directly from your papers, Josh, that allow you to challenge the machine to make sure that the machine did the right thing. My conclusion right now in practice is that asking voters to do that is extremely unlikely to succeed, and I think the reason why your approach that I adopted in Helios is interesting is because it allows auditors and voters to be different people, and the auditors can come into the system, check that the machine is doing the right thing, and the machine can't tell the difference between the auditors and the voters. And so that's great. The auditors will probably have secure machines and everything will look fine to them, and then those folks with the Stuxnet Trojan will not challenge the ballot and their votes will be modified. So that's why I think that we do have theoretical solutions to this, but I don't know if we can make them practical yet.
No.
Okay. Jeremy Epstein, SRI International. Before, Ben, you jump up and run out of the room, I wanted to actually challenge one thing you said, which is you suggested that Israel might be a good test case, and actually I think Israel is a good test case of why this isn't a good idea, because there's probably no other country in the world where there are enemies more likely to directly attack elections, because there's such a state of war and such a history of attacking each other's websites and everything like that. So it's hard for me to imagine a worse example for testing internet voting than Israel. Although, I mean, I understand what you're saying about E2E having certain mitigating factors, but if there's any problem anywhere, it's going to show up there. I wanted to make a comment also about the earthquake analogy, which is that we actually have a really good example of that, and that's what's happening in Haiti, where people are putting up, we had a huge earthquake, everything got destroyed, and people are putting up structures that they know are not resilient to earthquakes, but there's no other choice. They don't have the money to put up earthquake-resilient structures. Maybe we don't have any other choice. I mean, I'm not sure that I'm this pessimistic, but maybe we have no other choice but to put up structures, i.e. internet voting systems, that are going to get whacked. So anyway.
Good points.
I'd like to toss out one tactic that's regrettably, it's very U.S.-centric. I'm taking a very U.S.-centric approach here. But one tactic of If you really want to stop the adoption and use of broad-scale internet voting, or really even small-scale internet voting in the United States, there is one completely non-technological point that the advocacy community can key on. It's nothing to do with computers, and it's something you can insist on unalterably and at every possible stop, and that is, no matter what technology is used to conduct U.S. elections, those computers must be owned, operated, and under the sole control of local election officials. Yes, all 3,800 and some odd of them have to have their own data center and their own computers and their own IT budget that will support it. That'll keep things quiet for about 20 years at least, just because of the money requirement. And that's not to say that there aren't loads of other technological reasons why it's a bad idea and why most U.S. elections jurisdictions could never get the funding and the expertise to even try to do it safely. I'm not saying it is safe. I'm just saying that there's a much more fundamental bar. You don't even need to argue about whether the internet is email or unsafe or whatever. It's just the election officials don't have the money to do it, period.
Just a point of order. I think what we'll do, talking with the organizers, people who are standing in front of the mic, or mics, can have a final questions, but we will need to wrap things up pretty soon.
Josh, I want to challenge your claim that having a detectability option for determining that end users' votes have been compromised really isn't enough, in that you hold the election and we discover that 70-80% of the electorate's votes were compromised. Now what do we do? Hold the election again with the same flawed equipment?
Reformat your hard drive, no problem.
Yeah. That's not enough. I mean, really, what do we do? I don't think that's actually an answer. Detectability is important, but not sufficient.
But you can act. If you can detect it, you can act. Then you can know to rerun it if you can. If you don't know it hasn't if you don't know it's happened, then you get
Well, I mean, again, to be U.S. centric here, we know that just simply showing that there were problems with an election is not sufficient to get it to be rerun. We've seen that multiple times in this country. One of the things that I said earlier is that we need new laws. Not that that's an easy thing to do, but at a minimum, we need laws to rerun elections which have been shown to be compromised, and we do not have that. I know that some other countries do, so I'm just saying that's U.S.
Okay. And I guess since I've been challenged, I'll agree with you, in fact. I agree completely that it's not enough. End-to-end verifiability is fundamentally an auditing mechanism. It's a detection mechanism and nothing more. But it's a valuable detection mechanism in places where we don't have detection now. It does allow you to detect. And it's not something that's an either or, and you know, I think hopefully I can raise that issue in just a moment. But it's not, you know, well, we have to do it over the internet with no paper to do end to end. That's not true. My favorite voting system agrees with yours, Barbara. I think poll station, paper based, and also end to end. These are separate things with separate properties. We can do both. Anyway, sorry, rant and rant.
For two of the metaphors that were used earlier, the Russian roulette metaphor and the earthquake metaphor, the probability of a crisis or a disaster occurring was one. But for the other metaphor, for meltdown, nuclear power plant meltdown, you can argue about whether a crisis is in the natural course of events, but clearly the probability of the crisis is something less than one. It is not inevitable. So I ask you, if internet voting is rolled out, is a crisis inevitable?
Well, my view is, if an election can be rigged, if you use a technology that is riggable, sooner or later, someone will rig it. So I would say the probability is one. Now, for how long, that's a different question. But eventually, it will get rigged.
Barbara, do you think it's impossible to rig paper-based elections?
I think paper-based elections have been rigged.
All about a tag team, so I've...
Okay. So I have one final targeted question, and I'm afraid... I've actually asked others, so I'm going to pick on you, Christian. The literature is pretty consistent is quite consistent in defining end-to-end verifiability as including universal verifiability. The system in Norway does not have it, but you're still calling it end-to-end. Isn't that deceptive?
Well, is it deceptive? I don't know. We're certainly very clear on what it is, that it is not universal, that we cannot do it because of the ballot structure.
Then why use the term end-to-end verifiable?
Because it is verifiable by an auditor from end-to-end. I don't know. I'm happy to make up a different term.
Yes, please do.
Okay. We'll look into that if the system is ever used again.
Thank you. And thank you very much to all the panelists for their patience and their great observations. And I really appreciate all their time and efforts. Thank you.